You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Coming up in this week's Parish Council, Black Friday, Cyber Monday, Let's Fight Over a Telly, Tony Blair's Christmas card. Ooh. Russell Brand, why is he so pompous? And for the television review, we watch Inside Tatler.
Well, hello everybody and welcome back to the podcast from the Rocking Vicar. This is the Parish Council. I'm Magnus Shaw, and why don't you do a little dance, make a little love and get down tonight, because we are joined, as always, by Terence Dackham.
You're not Juliet Harris.
I'm certainly not. Not last time I checked. No.
Oh, dear, oh, dear, it's disappointing. Hello, Magnus Shaw.
Hello.
Now, I just want to check something with you. Now, assuming you left from some desolate northern airfield, I've established that you've just completed an 8,708-mile round trip to the land of the free.
Yeah. Well,
specifically Florida.
I think more than that, because having arrived in the Florida, I travelled around as well. So
there we are, and probably take it up to about 10,000.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Now, to establish a further fact, one of members of the jury, I put it to you, Magnus Shaw, establishing facts. Mm. One of the first messages you sent me upon your return was, you know, just a sort of friendly request that I might look out for Fleetwood Mac tickets, as you're anxious to go and see them. So if I hear of any tickets going spare, I should let you know.
Yes, please.
That's true, isn't it?
It is true, yes.
So I said, hey, you should buy tickets for the Isle of Wight Festival. Yeah. Fleetwood Mac are appearing there. And you said, as you returned from your 10,000-mile round trip, oh, no, the Isle of Wight, quote, that's too far, it's miles away.
It is, yes. You know where I live and you know where the Isle of Wight is. It's hundreds of miles away.
Ah, now I can tell you, it's 217 miles.
Because
I checked from your
plural, yes,
from your barren, desolate, blighted, northerly town.
Exactly,
217 miles to the Isle of Wight. Yeah. Well, you've just been 10,000 miles back to Florida, man.
Yeah, that's true, but it would actually take me probably just as long to get to the Isle of Wight because no aeroplanes would be involved. You see.
Well, I mean, just to escape your windswept, wild, cheerless landscape to visit the hedonistic joy of the Isle of Wight.
Yeah, plus you don't get a full set at a festival, you see. The Mac will be on for maybe 90 minutes tops at a festival. Mm. Yeah. I'm not big on, much like yourself, residing under canvas for any length of time. It's not the kind of evening out I was anticipating. But I appreciate the tip.
Yes. Well, I thought, I do take your point, but I did think instead of Florida or California, you know, you could make it a full-scale holiday on the Isle of Wight. A Fleetwood Mac extravaganza, if you will. So I researched the best activities on the Isle of Wight.
Okay.
So if you would, yes, because I think, you know, you could make it, you know, make a holiday of it. Don't go to Florida or Greece.
No.
So this is what you could do, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think you'll like these. Ranked number 67 of 90 attractions on TripAdvisor.
Yes.
Bonchurch landslip.
Oh, lovely.
Go and see where some land has slipped.
Of course.
Here's a review from a visitor, August 2014. I have never felt so unwelcome, especially the person who lives next door to Bonchurch Pottery. Shame on you. That sounds like a good one.
Yeah,
put that in your diary.
Is it sort of the faulty towers of geological earth movements?
It does sound rather like that. How about number 71? Mm. This is a place called Sunken Secrets. Sounds good, doesn't it? Pity it wasn't open, says a TripAdvisor visitor. So, well, we can't find out much about that one, obviously. But maybe the Isle of Wight Shipwreck Centre. Here's the review. Yes. Just lots of bit of junk. That's the review of that one. Finally, well, I've got one. This one's going to persuade you, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So, you know, now I think the Isle of Wight, you're going to be thinking, no, I'm going to go 90 minutes to Fleetwood Mac and, ending on a high, St. Michael the Archangel Church in Shalfleet, Isle of Wight.
Sounds lovely.
This is the latest review, in fact. A more than averagely interesting church.
Yeah, well, damning with faint praise there.
That's the actual review on TripAdvisor. So, you know, the Isle of Wight, come for a week, it'll feel like a year.
Yes, I can see what Queen Victoria took to her heart about the Isle of Wight there. It's, yeah, lovely. Love it. It sounds wonderful. We could perhaps do a competition. You know, the first prize is a holiday on the Isle of Wight, and the second prize is two holidays on the Isle of Wight.
Yeah, third prize, go and live there. Now, you in your America.
Mm.
The USA, you know, it's been responsible for many delightful imports to this country.
Yes.
Disney, Pepsi, The Simpsons, The Godfather, Diana Ross. It's a long list.
It's a long list.
But one import we could probably lose without too much distress is your American Black Friday, where we've quickly established a sort of tradition for people to queue up in order to fight over a flat-screen television in Asda at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
So we now have Black Friday, Cyber Monday, Small Business Saturday. You're our marketing and branding expert.
Yeah.
What are they doing? What are they doing, Magnus?
Well, they're selling things, aren't they? That's the point. and as you say, we soak up Americana like some giant sponge, don't we, in the UK. And Black Friday has been a thing in the US for many, many years. It's the day after Thanksgiving, and all the stores throw open their doors and discount things like crazy. In fact, you know how the January sales now start on December the 15th or something in this country. In the States, Black Friday starts at 6 p.m. on Thanksgiving, which is the last Thursday in November. So I went along to Walmart.
Oh, no, you
yeah,
didn't.
Yeah, I did.
Oh, my God.
About 7 p.m. on Thanksgiving Thursday. Actually, I went along to buy some cough mixture. The germs circulating in the plane have rather given me something of a chesty cough. And I went to buy some cough mixture and also to have a look at what happened.
Did he write Lolita? No, that was Nabokov. You said chesty cough.
Yes, of course, Chestnikov's the playwright, isn't he? Cherry Orchard and all that. Yeah,
yes,
that's right.
Of course, yes.
I went to see what happens in a Walmart on the beginning of Black Friday, which is 6 p.m. on the preceding Thursday. Yes, it was remarkable. But I did subsequently read that there was fisticuffs here in the UK. That's not the case in the US, or certainly in the Walmart I was in. But there's a lot of enthusiastic shopping going on. And this particular Walmart had marked down their large fireplace mirrors from $50 to $10. So absolutely everybody had a giant mirror in their trolley. And also Barbie scooters. I don't mean motor scooters. Scooters were marked down from like $100 to $25 or something.
Oh, I'd had one of
those.
So
everybody had one of those as well. The amusing thing was I was walking around with a bottle of cough mixture, which is what I bought. But then I went to the Black Friday sales proper in a mall called the Tyrone Mall. In Orlando on the actual day itself. And, you know, it's not bad. It's just like Christmas shopping, you know, it's fine. But then discounts, you can't ignore the high value of the discounts. There's a lot of shops are saying anything in this shop, 50% off, straight up and down. Just come in here, buy anything, you'll pay half for it. So it's, you know, the deals are pretty good, but it's not unpleasant. And, no more so than Christmas shopping is unpleasant at the best of times.
Okay. Can I ask you a question about it, though? So, I wonder if it's becoming counterproductive. I mean, I wouldn't go near a town centre on Black Friday for fear of being caught up in this mayhem. And it must surely be negative for Asda or Tesco, you know, to be featured on the television news, as they were over here, due to people fighting over a discounted pair of underpants.
No. Because the message that sends is that the sale, the discounts are so good that look at the lengths people will go to avail themselves of these things. There's not a problem about that at all. People are so keen to buy things from you that they will engage in physical violence. It might be a fairly low rent message, but it's not a negative message.
I have access to the live feeds of the main American television stations here.
Okay.
And like you were saying, I noticed that most of the advertising on Thanksgiving was referring to, it's now referred to as Black Friday weekend.
Yes, absolutely. It's holiday weekend, Thanksgiving weekend. So you've got Thanksgiving itself, which is like Christmas Day. Nothing stirs or moves. Everybody's with their family. And then it switches around and everybody is mobbing the shops on the Friday. And then the Saturday it goes back to ghost town again. Everybody somehow goes back to their family. What I did see was clearly people had Thanksgiving dinner, you know, in the afternoon of the Thursday, and then gone en masse as a family to the supermarkets.
It's the new cathedral, isn't
It's the cathedral of consumerism, drawn people away from their dinner table and their bellies swollen with turkey and yams and into the stores for the start of Black Friday. But I didn't see any ill will between shoppers at all, just lots of enthusiastic buying, including myself. You know, I can't look at a decent clothes shop and see the sign 50% off everything without scoring a thing or two. So I got myself a very nice Grandmaster Flash t-shirt.
Right. Yes. But nobody trying to rip it out of your hands as we had over here in Wembley.
Not at all. I suppose the question that always arises with these sort of things, like the Boxing Day sales, and there's some poor sap's got to go and man the till when they could be at home in the bosom of their family. So you have to feel for them a bit. But a lot of them were saying, I'm happy of the hours. So I think they were probably getting over the usual rate.
Double bubble.
It happens big style in America. And, of course, anything that happens big style in America happens over here. I'm happy to report to regular listeners will know that this is an important feature of the podcast here. I did eat a cronut.
Oh, hurrah. Yeah.
and photograph it. Do you want me to post it somewhere? Since that little bakery in New York invented the cronut, of course, all the big chains now sell a cronut.
I still haven't had
quick
one.
Upon it, and I had one from Dunkin' Donuts. Very nice. I'd like to bring you a breaking story. They're disgusting, but of course they're not. They're absolutely lovely. Yeah.
5,000 calories. Yeah. Now, I suppose you will already have received your Christmas card from your Tony Blair. And
I think you're fonder of Tony Blair than I am.
I wish for a moment that this was a visual podcast, but the listener might want to dash to Google and look for Blair's Christmas card 2014, you'll see what we're talking about. You'll see Tony and Cherie staring at the camera. Cherie, she looks rather reverential.
Yes.
But Tony Blair looks like he's going to nut the photographer.
Yes, I have the picture here in front of me.
Yes.
He does look rather intense, doesn't he?
He really has a
cattle prod inserted in somewhere unfortunate, doesn't it?
Yeah. It does what it looks like. But as I say, he's about to come and slug it out
with the smile there, isn't he? How strange, yeah.
It really is.
And I've always thought, we know Tony Blair earns, a million and a half for a half hour speech or whatever particularly if it's for some Russian oligarch's soap factory or something, isn't it? You would think with his access to finances, he'd get that little black tooth coloured in, wouldn't you?
I suppose so. I mean, the other thing is that it's a Christmas card, yet he's standing so stiff and formal that the other interpretation that he's about to be led out to a firing squad.
Yes, well, we can only live in hope. I think the main offender on this card here is the font. The message is Season's Greetings, which I suppose is suitably politically correct, isn't it? There's no mention of Christmas there. But the font is something else. It looks like, I don't know, it's from a postcard, a Christmas card from 1972, doesn't it?
Yeah, this was received so much attention that many media outlets actually checked with his office that, you know, it wasn't a gag and this was like had been knocked up by, you know, some kid in using Photoshop. But no, it is absolutely genuine, and it led me into considering how so many people haven't mastered media management. Because another high-profile example this week was at the White House, where your President Obama was speaking at a Thanksgiving event, yeah. And his daughters, Sasha and Malia, but stood in the background acting, acting like teenagers, which is what they are. They look bored and as if they couldn't wait to return to their iPhones, YouTube, and One Direction videos.
Which is probably the case, yeah.
Is this all poor media management, or is there something rather naively sweet about all of this?
Yes, I don't know. Everything is media management now, which seems astonishing that so many, particularly politicians, get it so badly wrong. I have to feel sorry for the offspring of any prominent celebrity, and particularly a politician. They didn't ask for the gig, did they? And Obama's particularly protective of his daughters, but I guess this is the one time of year that they have to make a public appearance. They don't look particularly cheery. As you said, the story attached to this was that a staffer at the White House, a member of staff there, went public on social media to say that they should get some class, they should dress up and smile for these publicity shots. Now, you really...
Of course, she's a Republican.
Yeah, she is a Republican, yes. However, one has to wonder what possesses somebody who earns their crust from working closely with the president and his people to take to social media to criticize the president's daughters. You might as well put a drawing pin on the president's chair, mightn't you?
Well, you might, and as you say, she should have, because she's now no longer working as a senior Republican official.
When this story broke over in the States, I sort of set a mental stopwatch going. As to how quickly she would cease to be employed by the White House. And I think it took about 36 hours before the announcement came that she'd chosen to withdraw from her position, which is, I'm sure, a euphemism as to what actually happened. One can only imagine the level of carpeting she received.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, well, I imagine Mr. and Mrs. Obama were absolutely furious. Indeed. Because, I mean, I think, as you say, you know, the Blairs the dress sense was the least part of their problem there. But poor Malia and Sasha, they're heavily criticised by Elizabeth Loudon, the Republican official, because they dress like every other teenager in America and the UK.
Of course. And as I say, I do feel sorry for youngsters in this position because we can all recall being of a certain age and thinking your parents were nothing more than a complete liability to your coolness and your credibility. And that was just with your parents as school teachers or managers or whatever. When your parent is the leader of the free world, the possibility of, you know, feeling exposed must be quite large, and perhaps they were betraying that in the photo, or perhaps, yeah, just a bad photo perhaps, but they don't ask for this job, and one has to feel sorry for them, just wonder at the foolishness of criticizing your boss's daughters.
Now the gift that just will not ever go away and just keeps on giving. We're recording this on Friday, the 5th of December, and today's Sun newspaper has on its front page, more or less the whole of the front page, is an official, as they call it, Sun YouGov poll on Russell Brand. The Nation speaks. And in their poll, 68%, which they refer to as a landslide, I'm not quite sure about that, they say landslide, 68% say he's a hypocrite, 64% say he's not funny. Well, as I was just alluding to there, he, Russell Brand, never that far from a press photographer, a television studio, or a camera, Russell Brand, back in the news again, this time espousing a cause for fair rents in Hoxton, East London. No problem, good for him, and so on. But Russell Brand, he has a trait that I find most unattractive. When he's challenged on his views, where he's generally these days excitingly telling us he's going to join in some sort of anarchic revolution, mm-hmm. when he's challenged, he becomes terribly aggressive and patronising, giving that sort of chilling smile and calling his interviewer mate in the most derogatory fashion. Well, are you joining, Magnus, are you joining Russell Brand on the front line of the revolution?
Yeah, probably. Yes, yes. I'm all for Russell Brand. I like flies in the ointment. I like brickbats being chucked from whichever direction at the powerful and authoritarian members of our community. And I think that involves being an irritant. I think if Russell Brand published his thoughts as academic papers, they would come and go without a twinkle. If you're going to be an antagonist, be an antagonist, be irritating. And if I was Russell Brand, I would find the fact that the Sun had taken against me as high praise and affirmation that I was doing the right thing. Clearly, Russell Brand is not a politician, and he's not a folk hero, and he's not going to lead an anarchic revolution. However, he is using the platform that he has to make things as difficult as possible for the people he's addressing, and I'm all for that.
I want to ask you about his chippiness. Right now, he was very politely challenged in Downing Street this week by Channel 4's Parak O'Brien, and he started jabbing his finger and towering over O'Brien and calling him a snide. And this was because O'Brien pointed out that Brand lives in a very swish, plush apartment, and he asked if Brand knew the value of the property. This is what Brand said in a televised clip: "Snides like you, mate, undermine. You're a snide. All right, let's do one."
I don't know what that means, really.
No, I don't want to be part of Russell Brand's revolution. I understand that you might support his cause and so on and so forth, and other people may. I don't. But he seems to be believing his own publicity. You know, when as we talked about a few weeks ago, you know, he was sacked by MTV. I'm not sure he had this kind of chip on the shoulder mentality that he has now. Yeah. It seems to me that the moment he's challenged, he falls into this kind of aggressive finger jabbing role, which is, I find it's very unattractive.
Yeah, it probably is. And if he's any kind of mouthpiece, he's a flawed mouthpiece. Of course he is. And you know, in many ways, he's building the second half of his career on this sort of quasi-political platform. But I think you kind of either take to somebody or you don't. And I quite take to him, and when he does trip over, I can shrug and say, yeah, he's a sort of self-acknowledged fool at times. But I don't buy this hypocrisy thing. This is ridiculous. How would we feel about Russell Brand if he lived in this expensive apartment and said that he didn't give a jot about people less well off and successful than himself? We would think that was equally awful. So in many ways, he can't really win.
Again, Magnus Shaw, that's not the point, if you're leaping in. It's his reaction.
I understand that. And you make a valid point about that. I think if he's failed in any way, it is that when he gave his interview on Newsnight, which must be round about a year ago, to Jeremy Paxman, which caused a bit of a stir, I think he really had the momentum of the public behind him. Most people who saw that thought, well, yeah, he's a bit of a goof, but the points he's making are salient and important, and a lot of people echoed them. I think he squandered that momentum. I think he went off and did Hollywood stuff and showbiz stuff just at the point when he really could have lent himself to an important wave of public opinion. Now he's come back and tried to pick it up, and I think that's difficult to do. And I think he squandered the goodwill that he had at that point. he's a big mouth. You know, he's like Morrissey or John Lydon or whoever else you might want to point at. He's going to get it wrong quite a lot because he lets his mouth run off. But I like people that stick their head above the parapet and make waves. But I agree, yeah, he should be able to defend his position without resorting to, you know, playground stuff, because that will undermine any credibility or agreement that he finds out there. If people just see him mouthing off at people who disagree with him, that's not smart. But I still like it. On the plane on the way home, by coincidence, I watched his Messiah Complex 90-minute stand-up show, which is two-thirds very strong. It sort of does dissolve in the end into some kind of quasi mystical philosophy, which totally lost me, I have to say. But in the main, he says some interesting things, and he's funny. I mean, for the Sun to say somebody is hypocritical and unfunny is rich indeed. I mean, the hypocritical and unfunny would be two words I would happily apply to the Sun newspaper, so no problems there. But he does, yeah, I suppose, just confirming what you've said, gets so far and then melts somewhat, which he does in Messiah Complex, is exactly what he does there. But you can still admire flawed people, you know?
Do you know what it is, Magnus? I think it's our age-old issue that we've discussed in terms of other people as well before. He's now, I expect, surrounded by pals and chums who constantly tell him how wonderful he is. The money is flowing into, you know, his various bank accounts with glee, and there's just nobody that has the clout to say, hold on, Russell, that's not the way to do it.
Yeah, you could be doing this better. Yeah, you could be making a fairer fist of this. I would agree he could be making a fairer fist of it, but at least he's making a fist, is what I would say.
Do you know what, Magnus Shaw? I understand that you are bringing us a competition where we can win our weight in T-Rex albums. Am I right?
Yeah, this is a great competition. I'm really, really glad we've got this because I promise you, I don't have the prize here. So whoever wins it will not receive it scratched and covered in fluff and
dust. Getting it direct from the record company.
Yeah, getting it direct from the record company. So there's no danger that we're going to give it a listen or anything. Or if you receive it listened, it's not our fault. You won't. It will be hermetically sealed. But it's a really, really smashing prize, and you know, one of those occasions where you think, oh, I wish I could enter this myself. So let me tell you what we're giving away. We don't usually do the competitions on the podcast, but this is an exclusive for podcast listeners. This is I think really the third part of this huge re-release sequence from the T-Rex back catalogue, and this is the vinyl collection. It's an 8 album box set, and I can tell you, you'll be getting the album T-Rex, then Electric Warrior, The Slider, Tanks, Zinc Alloy and the Hidden Riders of Tomorrow, Bolan Zip Gun, Futuristic Dragon and Dandy in the Underworld, all in one big vinyl box set. You will need a turntable. We can't provide the turntable, I'm afraid. It really is a marvellous thing. It's a limited edition, so there won't be many of you with this, and you won't have to pay a penny. If you are the lucky winner, we will send it all to you, post-paid and all the rest of it. You'll be able to listen to stuff like Ride a White Swan, Hot Love, Children of the Revolution, Solid Gold, Easy Action, you know the deal, 20th Century Boy, they're all there. And for the vinyl junkies, this is a must-own. And all we require is the answer to a question. So here's the question. There is a T-Rex movie, which I think was made around 1973, called Born to Boogie. Interestingly enough, it was shot by a member of the Beatles. Okay, a member of the Beatles made the movie Born to Boogie, which is a documentary about Mark Bolan and T-Rex. We just need you to tell us which member of the Beatles was responsible for that movie. And all we want is an email from you, containing your email address, which it inevitably will, your name, and the answer to that question. And you send that to, I'm just pausing while everybody goes and gets a biro, hello@dacomshawmedia.com. Hello@dacomshawmedia.com. And we'll just wait a week and pick one of those entries at random. And that wonderful box set is going to be yours if that is you.
Well, that can't be. That's a pretty good. It's a pretty good Christmas gift, isn't
it?
Yeah,
lovely. Yeah, it's a really, really nice set. And yeah, if you're a bit of a T-Rex completist, you've got to get hold of this.
So, which Beatle was involved in the production of Born to Boogie? And it's Hello at DackhamshawMedia.com.
That's the one.
God, it's very, very easy. An easy win for somebody.
Yeah.
There. Now, last week, Magnus Shaw, while you were living La Vida Loca, I was chatting to the unimaginably lovely Juliet about binge-watching television series. And we were talking about how I'm rerunning Curb Your Enthusiasm from season one with the aim of reaching the last episode before Christmas.
Oh, very wise, yes.
Mm, but word reaches me that you're undertaking a similar binge, but with different series.
Yes. Well, I was by accident. I know yours is by close design. It sounds like you have some kind of matrix mapped out in order to absorb all these episodes of Curb. Yeah, but mine was by accident. On a couple of nights whilst I was in the US. Did I tell you I'd been in the US, by the way?
Oh, my God, you mentioned it.
Okay, right. Well, on a channel called TBS, which I think stands for To Be Serious. I think it stands for
Turner Broadcasting System.
No.
It's Ted Turner. It's Ted Turner's
To Be Serious. Well,
that's, yeah, Turner Broadcasting System. Their marketing is the little TV.
Yes, that's right. It's a comedy channel. Pretty good way. So it's something we could do with here, actually. I think somebody should take up the gauntlet and have a rolling comedy channel in the UK, because, you know, it's just really useful for when there's very little else on. You can say, well, I'll watch the rolling comedy channel, because as long as the selections are good enough, it's really handy fallback, which is what I found. Anyway, over a couple of nights, they had a Friends marathon. They weren't showing, of course, all the episodes of Friends. That would have absorbed their channel for about a year, but lots and lots of episodes of Friends. And then a few nights later, they had a Seinfeld marathon, a dozen or so episodes of Seinfeld. And I watched most of both. And I just thought this is quite interesting, because they were both enormously successful comedies, certainly in the States. Seinfeld over here suffered from terrible scheduling, so it never took off in quite the same way as Friends did. Friends was a huge hit for Channel 4 over here, of course. But I just thought, let's compare them side by side. Seinfeld came a bit later, but they were both pretty much in the same vein of American situation comedy. And I hadn't seen either for a long time, so I compared the two, thinking that Seinfeld would have the edge. I have to say, without a shadow of a doubt, by country mile, I enjoyed the Friends marathon considerably more. And I was surprised at how weak I found Seinfeld all these years later. That might just be me, because I know there are Seinfeld adherents the world over, but I much, much far preferred Friends. I know Jerry Seinfeld, when he set up that show, did so in something of a reaction to Friends on that kind of comedy, because he said it had to be a show about nothing, where nobody hugged and no lessons were learned. Well, there's lots of hugging and lessons learned in Friends, but I found it far warmer, far more engaging, far more endearing than the Seinfeld shows.
That's interesting. Yeah. I'm just going to enable people not to have to tweet or contact you, because in your desolate northern outpost where you have your free view, those of us with cable and satellite, of course, in the UK, we do have multiple comedy channels.
There's Comedy Central and stuff. Yes, yeah, but they're not UK based.
No, they have a European version. TBS, they've been doing this for over a decade now. It's called their non-stop comedy block, and these kind of it's almost like having a box set, they're running in real time on the TV. Nothing wrong with Friends, but it's strange, you know, I'll always favour Curb or Seinfeld over Friends, because I see them as glorious sort of vignettes of life in 25 minutes. There's so many subplots to tie up, yet Larry David, he always manages it in both Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm. And I think the beauty of Seinfeld, there's often a sting in the final scene that pulls the whole of the thing together. But the most long-lasting, in terms of continued endearment amongst comedy shows, are those where everyone stays in character. And this, I think this is as true in The Simpsons as in Curb and Seinfeld. And the most outrageous and, I suppose, unlikely scenarios unfold. But the key protagonists maintain their character traits. And, you know, I've written a comedy myself, as you know, and this was always an aspect to remember. I stuck to this sort of code when writing for Spitting Image, for example. We always, I always made sure that the characters stayed in that character. We didn't suddenly make them go off kilter and behave, you know, outside of how they would in any given situation. Yeah. And I think that's the key to the comedy. Friends, I'm not so sure if it stood the test of time so well.
Well, I mean, it did for me. What struck me was that the writing was so good on Friends. There's such a high standard of writing on Friends. The gags are razor sharp, and I think the characterizations are terrific as well. And to juggle six characters and give them all three dimensions and really make you care about them is not easy to do over, let's face it, 20-minute episodes because of the advertising breaks. It's a great feat of writing. I'm not condemning Seinfeld at all. I just came away with more affection for Friends than Seinfeld. I thought Seinfeld was pretty good. And I'm not including Curb in this because Curb Your Enthusiasm is probably better than the two of them combined. Curb Your Enthusiasm is an extraordinary piece of comedy television which will take some beating or equaling. It really is an extraordinary feat of comedy. That is.
Do you think the appeal with Friends might be that, you know, I find it's, and I'm saying this in a good way, that it's very much of its time, yeah. And it's fine if we're sort of looking for like a nostalgia fest for, you know, that particular key period.
In a way, I don't know if it's so much nostalgia, is that anybody who watched Friends regularly, and that was pretty much most people in the UK at one point, very quickly, and certainly by the time it finished, felt they intimately knew those six characters, their trials, tribulations, hopes, worries, fears, idiosyncrasies, and all the rest. And so all these years later, when we haven't seen many episodes in a long while, it is rather like much-loved old friends calling to see you again, having emigrated or whatever, you know, having been away from you for a long time. It is like them coming back to see you again, which feels quite joyous more than nostalgic, I think. And I really thought, oh, I remember, you know, this, that, and the other. And it was like catching up with people I knew. And, you know, I think that's the strength of a show like Friends, is that it transcends a scripted comedy and sort of becomes a window on people that you feel very affectionate for and that you know very well.
Do you know what I think is a common feature in all three of those that we've mentioned, is a really strong supporting cast.
Yes.
When you think about it, they even rather minor characters, and particularly those that recur, are just so beautifully cast that you can't, you know, when you think of George Costanza's parents,
Gunther in the Friends.
I was just going to say Gunther in Friends, or Susie Green in Curb Your Enthusiasm. You know, they're just so strongly written and so beautifully cast that it's almost impossible to imagine anybody else in the roles. And I think that's, you know, perhaps something that sometimes British both dramas and particular comedies could learn from. I think as much attention is spent on the detail as on the main characterization.
Don't throw anything away, you know. Capitalize on every possibility, even in your side characters, but perhaps particularly in your side characters, perhaps that's the third dimension, that's the depth, isn't it, the co-stars and I agree. Yeah, there's loads of great side characters in Friends and in Seinfeld, and certainly in Curb. And of course, in Curb, sometimes they are famous people who really exist.
Yes.
Yeah, Ted Danson and Mary Steenburgen and so on are used to great comic effect in Curb. I think Curb is in. I wouldn't have done a three-way comparison because I just see Curb in a different sort of
alone,
dimension.
Yeah.
It exists in its own universe. Yeah, yeah.
I agree. I imagine, Magnus Shaw, that you don't need much of an introduction to Tatler magazine. I'm guessing.
I'm choking up already with recognition. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
I'm only guessing, but I imagine you're a subscriber. And I could actually picture you appearing in the pages, perhaps at one of the society balls, shooting parties, or the polo
whenever
matches.
Whenever I buy a new racehorse, they tend to feature it. Yeah.
I thought so. This week on BBC Two, the second episode of 3 was broadcast. Inside Tatler, a behind-the-scenes look at life through those revolving doors in Hanover Square. Your kind of people, Magnus Shaw.
That's not. I wouldn't say they're not my kind of people, because I think it's wrong to say that you hate posh people in the same way that it's wrong to say that you hate Irish people or American people or you know, any other grouping. It's ignorant to say that you hate a whole group of people who you've never met. It's ridiculous. So it's not a circle I move in. Very few people do, and I have no aspirations to do so, but it would be wrong to say I dislike them, because I don't know them. The only way I can see this show is in terms of a television program rather than people portrayed in it. And I just thought this was an intensely boring piece of television. And I really, this is not coming from any socialist soapbox standpoint. Mm. It was just, within 15 minutes, I was bored rigid, because there was, and you know this is my favorite word, but there was no jeopardy. Nothing really happened. There was no narrative arc. I didn't really care what was going to transpire. You know, when there was a very important photo shoot, it wasn't cancelled at the last minute or the photographer failed to turn up. Everything happened exactly as planned and everybody was very pleased about it. Well, I'm delighted for Tatler, but that does not make a riveting documentary. I struggled to get to the end of this because it was so dull. There was a piece on how Tatler covers independent schools and how they publish a guide to independent schools and how they go to the schools and photographed them, interviewed, and nothing happened. I mean, they just went to the schools, photographed them, interviewed some people, and published it. It was a Jeopardy vacuum. And of course, as we all know, Jeopardy is the handle on which great television tends to hang. So inside Tatler, I felt like I went inside Tatler and there was nothing there.
I wonder if a lot of people, though, like to have a little glimpse behind the scenes of a world that perhaps many, wouldn't be seeing. And maybe that was the appeal of it, that, one got glimpses into this world. Yes, Kate Reardon at that school, the Western Burt School for Girls, giving the end of term speech. One of the things that intrigued me, this is not really terribly relevant to the television show, but the narrator, Lawrence Fox, kept referring to the fact that it's got a small circulation, and I thought, oh, okay, I'll look this up. It sells over 88,000 copies a month. Now, there's plenty of magazines that would like to have that small circulation of 88,000 copies per month. So I'm not quite sure why they said it was a small circulation magazine. So you wouldn't be tempted to go to the Tatler bystander ball at the Hurlingham Club for 60 quid a pop. One thing that interested me about the people that they were interviewing, particularly the young people, there was this Tatler bystander ball, which is for youngsters. 13-year-old girl interviewed. It was just the reassurance and articulate nature of the well-schooled. And now I'm not saying that pompously. I have a point to make here, because first of all, there was the general rule of thumb for all young people here. We saw the teenage girls who were interviewed were pleasant and sensible. The teenage boys that were interviewed were appalling and
of
louche.
Course. Yes, of course. Yeah.
But possibly where I might stagger slightly into your socialist ideal. Uh-huh. is that it did strike me. I mean, these young people were generally, and as I said, particularly the well-spoken and articulate teenage girls they spoke to, you know, that's how I want education to be for everybody in this country.
Yes, of course, yes, yeah.
That was how it made me feel. See, you know, I've been to a number of independent schools in the last few years. Sometimes I even get invited in. And I'm always overwhelmed by the facilities and the sheer pleasantness and you know gorgeousness of the surroundings and the sort of enthusiasm of the staff and the pupils, everybody working together. And I just think, oh, you know, why can't we have that everywhere?
Well, you get invited into public schools. I, in a similar sort of way, was expelled from one and never invited back. So.
Oh dear.
But yeah, I was independently educated. I was privately educated, and as I say, we didn't take to each other, and they ended up showing me the door. But of course, yes, a high standard of education is a terrific thing, and if only it was available to everybody. But I don't think, you know, this documentary even took us into that debate in any shape, way or form, really. It was like a brochure. It was like Tatler. That was the point, I think. This was not a documentary about Tatler. It was a documentary like Tatler. And if anybody's picked up Tatler in the hairdressers or the the dentist waiting room and flicked through it, it's quite dull. And this was quite dull.
There was one quote from the editor, Kate Reardon, that I think should be printed out in large font and put on the wall of every magazine in the world.
Okay.
Because I thought this says it all. You if you were still awake, you may have noticed that they commissioned a lengthy piece that they in fact didn't use because they felt it wasn't good enough, about the 80s. They did a sort of 80s
retro thing.
So this piece wasn't considered good enough. This is what the editor, Kate Reardon, said, and I wrote it down. Oh, well, we can put it online so it isn't wasted. And that, I thought, tells you everything about publishing in the digital age and where magazines get it wrong. The piece wasn't good enough for the print edition of the Tatler. Yeah. We can put it online so it isn't wasted.
Whoops. Yeah, that fills one with the... with dread. If anything, it would be the reverse.
What about some of the characters, Magnus Shaw? Because dear Nick Coleridge, he's the sort of head man at Condé Nast. I've known him so many years. He's the nicest man in publishing. But I've seen this fellow, Hugo the photographer. I've seen him at racing and horse racing and polo events. Yeah. What an irritating man.
Yes, yeah, well... I can only concur. Yes, when he was photographing the little girls eating cake, you'd think he was he was on a glamour shoot, wouldn't you? Barking at them and give me more of that, give me more of that. Now put it near your face, and I'm like, oh, do you know what you're saying here? To be equitable, as with any walk of life, there are idiots and charmers. You know, there are wonderful people and dreadful people. I think social class is no barrier to that. So I wasn't against this show because it featured the moneyed and the privileged. I was just disappointed that what it chose to show us was so damn uninteresting.
You're a young fellow, but you remember the 80s.
And, oh, very well, yes.
They were referring to the 80s in this show, and Peter York wheeled out yet again. But I was in this thing that Tatler was obsessed with in the 80s and re-engaged with their obsession in this show. Sloan Rangers,
yes.
Just like punk rock. It didn't exist other than in Sloan Rangers in the mind of Peter York,
yes.
Who was trying to sell a book.
Yes, that's right.
At the time.
Yeah.
You know, these people didn't exist.
No. I mean, I think it probably referred to at the most about a dozen people who went to particular parties in particular apartment blocks in Chelsea, and that was about it. The idea that it was a social movement was very much hyped, yes, by Peter York, who wrote the book The Guide to Sloan Rangers, or The Sloan Rangers Guide, one or the other. It makes me wonder where Peter York derives his living since that book, really, but perhaps he's independently wealthy.
Maybe so, but that those fruity tones, you know, that he seems to save for when there's a microphone.
Yes, well, the interesting point with the accents, actually, because somebody pointed, many years ago, pointed this out to me, it might have been my mum, actually, that dreadfully pronounced... upper class dialect that the well-heeled English use is actually as inauthentic as Mockney, because when you get genuinely posh people, that is to say the royal family, they don't speak like that. The royal family don't speak like these sort of sub what we incorrectly refer to as Sloane Rangers. So it's very affected, isn't it? It's what they think they should be speaking like.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Peter York, by the way, of course, real name Peter Wallace.
Yeah, therein lies an illustration of affectation, doesn't it? Yeah.
So I think he gets by these. I think he does a column in one of the Sunday papers.
Oh, he's probably a brand consultant of Bulgari or something, isn't he?
Absolutely, yeah, no yeah, doubt. Yeah.
But
when
you're, you know, it's sort of like fame, isn't it? If you have to constantly remind everybody you're famous, you're not famous. So if you constantly have to remind people that you're rich and posh, you're not rich and posh, you know, because if you're the Duke of Edinburgh, you don't even have to mention it, do you? You know, so it's like David Bowie doesn't have to nudge you and say, hey, you know, I had a number one single once. You know, he's David Bowie. You know, he doesn't have to do that. So I think there were
right.
a lot of pretenders to the crown that we saw on this documentary, you know.
If you want to see the episode that we're referring to, which was the second of three, it is on the BBC iPlayer. And the third and final part of this little trilogy is on Monday at 9:00 p.m. This was Posh People Inside Tatler. It was narrated by Lawrence Fox and directed by Barnaby Coughlan.
I can't believe there's three parts to that. Astonishing. Dear, oh dear. Rather insightful TV review brings the curtain down on this particular episode of the Parish Council podcast. Just time to thank my colleague. We rejoined each other after a short break. Terence Dacom, the resplendent Terence Dacom over there. Thank you. I'll be seeing you. And and of course to Rona Martin, our exec producer, who does little introductions at the front of the podcast. Oh, and I must just remind you that our T-Rex competition is hot up and running. You can win the complete back catalogue of T-Rex on vinyl box sets, lovely thing. All you need to do is tell us which member of the Beatles made the movie Born to Boogie, which was the T-Rex documentary. Born to Boogie, shot by one member of the Beatles. Which member of the Beatles was that? Send us your email address and your answer and your name to hello@dacomshawmedia.com. hello@dacomshawmedia.com. We'll pick a winner out of the hat in about 7 days' time, and they will be walking away with that vinyl box set. We are off now. We are going to have our jewellery collections photographed for next month's Tatler, and we have to go and let Peter York in to consult on that. Thank you very much for listening. It's been a pleasure to be back amongst you. Sorry about the coughs. I'll try and get that cleared up for next week, and we thank you for joining us. You are our favourite listener, and we will see you in about 7 days' time. And well, that's about it. Thanks very much. Cheerio. Bye bye.
You have been listening to a Dacom Media production.